Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Darlene Kiger spent much of her life thinking about PFOA, the chemical DuPont used to make Teflon. Darlene's first husband was a chemist in DuPont's PFOA lab in West Virginia. In addition to an education and a generous salary, DuPont gave the family a free supply of PFOA, which Darlene used as soap in the dishwasher and to clean the car. When Darlene was only 36, she had an emergency hysterectomy. 8 years later, she had another surgery. Her husband used to come home from work sick. Jeremy Darling was 26 when he was diagnosed with testicular cancer. Carla Bartlett also developed kidney cancer. The three are part of a class action lawsuit along with 80,000 others who live and work in water districts near a DuPont plant in West Virginia. It's where DuPont used the chemical PFOA, which it refers to as C8, to make Teflon, the product responsible for the chemical giant's amazing rise to success. It's estimated that DuPont spread about 2.5 million pounds of the chemical into the area around its West Virginia plant alone. Evidence suggests DuPont knew as early as 1954 that C8 was toxic. By 1961, its own studies found C8 caused enlarged livers in rats and rabbits. Subsequent independent studies have shown that C8 is likely connected to so many diseases: high cholesterol, pregnancy-induced hypertension, thyroid disease, testicular cancer, kidney cancer, ovarian cancer, lymphoma, reduced fertility. The list goes on and on. Currently, more than 3,500 people have filed personal injury lawsuits against DuPont. Years of litigation have exposed how the company blatantly kept its own damaging research confidential while it continued to profit from C8. Too profitable to give up, DuPont continued to use the toxic chemical up until 2013. So what is being done to hold DuPont accountable and regulate chemicals to protect public safety? Joining me today are two guests. Nathaniel Rich wrote about the lawyer who exposed DuPont's decades-long history of chemical pollution for the New York Times Magazine. It was widely read. Nathaniel is author of the book Odds Against Tomorrow, and he joins us from the studios of WWNO in New Orleans. Hi, Nathaniel. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Sharon Lerner. Sharon is a reporter with The Intercept. Her three-part series on DuPont and the chemistry of deception came out last August, and you can find it at yourcallradio.org. Sharon joins us on the line from New York. Hi, Sharon. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Hello.
Well, it's great to have both of you. Your reporting is incredible and very disturbing because you expose so much incredible information. Before we dive in, let's just remind everyone about the company DuPont. We all probably can vision the label and the logo in our minds, but we might not know exactly what it makes. So, Nathaniel, can you give us a little thumb sketch of DuPont?
DuPont. Well, originally they're involved with gun manufacturing and gunpowder. And now it's one of the largest chemical companies in the world. They make everything from, Teflon, of course, and similar sort of nonstick surface substances. But, a million different products in industry that we don't think about that are used in everything from automobiles and airplanes to machine parts and so on, but it's a behemoth and it's now about to merge with Dow Chemical, one of its largest competitors.
And Sharon, what would you add to that?
I guess I would add that last year in July they spun off the part of their company that actually makes the product we're talking about. Teflon and PFOA, and now the substitutes for PFOA, and that company is called Chemours. So it's really a tangle, sort of what DuPont looks like right now, because it's spun off Chemours, which is really the chemical part of DuPont, and now it's merging with Dow, as Nathaniel just said, and now it's going to split into three different companies, one of which is going to make chemicals. So it's, you know, completely confusing at this point.
Hmm. Okay, so tell us more about this chemical. I mean, most of us are familiar with Teflon. So can you tell us more about that, Sharon?
Yeah. So there are a lot of confusing parts of it. So the PFOA or C8, which we've been writing about, is not part of Teflon exactly. It's called a surfactant, and it's basically a processing aid, something that they use to make it. So I guess that's an important thing to know. It's a perfluorinated chemical, which means that basically it has this base of carbons. It has eight carbons, which is why they call it C8. And then attached to each carbon are fluorine atoms. And that makes it incredibly useful in industry because it's really stable. Those are some of the strongest bonds in chemistry, carbon to fluorine. But it's also what makes it very hard to break down, to disintegrate, and which, you know, that's the main reason that it persists in the environment the way it does. And that's part of the reason that it's so worrisome, is that this chemical is expected to be on the Earth long after humans are gone for it, which is really hard to wrap your head around.
Well, it's also, Nathan, hard to wrap your head around the fact that this is in almost all of our bodies, 99.7% to be exact.
Yeah, because it's so, it's called, the term they use is bioresistant, and it doesn't degrade. It degrades extraordinarily slowly, and so it doesn't get out of your. It doesn't get out of nature essentially forever, as Sharon just said. But it also binds to the blood in the human body, and so it essentially, once it's in your bloodstream, it passes through your circulatory system to each organ in turn, and it kind of just stays there, and it accumulates there if you continue to ingest it.
And we've done a lot of shows about chemicals over the years. There are about 60,000 unregulated chemicals out there right now in all of the products we use. Sharon, can you remind us why these chemicals, the overwhelming majority of them, are not tested for safety?
Yeah, so there are a couple things. One is that many of them were introduced before we had an EPA or a chemical regulatory system or a chemical regulatory law. And you know, that law is called TSCA. Before TSCA, tens of thousands of chemicals were already in use, and those were grandfathered in when that law passed in the 70s. And now, but you know, TSCA didn't do that much for in terms of regulating or requiring testing, so that you can introduce the chemical to the market now and without presenting information about health. And that's because it's not required under TSCA. And one of the crazy things is that TSCA, this law, is being reformed. It's in the process right now. And a bill has just gone through, been approved both by the House and the Senate, and they're kind of conferencing them now, but neither of them does this thing, which is require health data for new chemicals.
We often hear about lobbyists for oil and gas, for example, lobbyists for big pharma. Most people don't know much about the chemical industry. I mean, it's not like you can name that many companies. It's just not a well-known industry. So, Sharon, can you talk about the lobbyists behind this, and is that why this law has not been strengthened?
Yeah, I can. So the main lobbying group is the American Chemistry Council, really powerful lobbying group. And I'm actually just looking for the number, which I don't can give you in a second. But they spend a huge amount on the reform of the law, and which, again, passed over the last year, but it's been in the works for quite some time. And I think it was, I want to check as I'm talking to you, but I believe, oh, here, $125 million was what the chemical industry spent on lobbying since 2014. And that's including from DuPont, $14 million from DuPont, but it's also Dow and Coke and the American Chemistry Council and many others.
Sharon Lerner is a reporter with The Intercept. Her three-part series on DuPont and the chemistry of deception came out last August. Nathaniel Rich wrote about the lawyer who exposed DuPont's decades-long history of chemical pollution for the New York Times Magazine. I hope you have some time over the weekend to read their work because it's really incredible. You can find their stories at yourcallradio.org. Nathaniel, let's dive in and talk about this lawyer. I mean, his story is really amazing. Most of this actually began to unravel for DuPont when a West Virginia farmer, Wilbur Tennant, took his complaint to attorney Rob Bellott. Tell us about Rob Bellott. And, you know, he was a partner at Taft, Stedinus, Hollister, and he received a direct call from the cattle farmer, Wilbur Tennant.
Yeah, that's right. And he's a fascinating, heroic figure. He had been at Taft for about 8 years. It was the only job he'd had after law school. And it's a corporate firm in Cincinnati that goes back to family of President Taft. And essentially their big business is representing chemical companies, defending chemical companies. And he received a call from this farmer from West Virginia out of the blue on his private line. And the farmer was complaining that all his cows were dying, and he lived near a DuPont plant, and he was convinced that DuPont was killing his cows somehow, but he didn't know exactly how. And, you know, Bellott might have hung up the phone if it were not for Wilbur Tennant saying the name of Bellott's own grandmother. And Bellott's grandmother lived nearby, and they had mutual friends. And after Tennant had failed to find anybody to help him locally, not only among the legal community in Parkersburg, West Virginia, but also veterinarians, doctors, politicians, local journalists. Nobody wanted to get involved because DuPont was so powerful in that town. He spoke to this neighbor who said, "Oh, well, I think so-and-so's grandson is an environmental lawyer. You should call him." And so he did. He called Bellott, not realizing that Bellott was essentially the wrong kind of environmental lawyer and that he defended chemical companies instead of going after them. But out of some sense of, I think, nostalgia and sentimentality, but also a sense that something seriously wrong was going on, he took the case and began his investigation.
And the farmer showed Bellott videotape of the animals. And for example, he says, "I've taken two dead deer and two dead cattle off this ripple. The blood runs out of their noses and out of their mouth. They're trying to cover up this stuff." The video showed a large pipe running into the creek, discharging green water with bubbles on the surface. At one point, the video cuts to a skinny red cow standing in the hay. Patches of its hair are missing. Its back is humped. And so Bellott saw this video of these animals on his farm, and he said that 153 of these animals he lost.
Yeah, and the videos are horrific. I mean, they're really they have the quality of a horror film, and I think a couple of them are up on the Intercept site with very fittingly ominous music as a soundtrack. But they're these horrific videos of all these cows who are just look terrible. I mean, without knowing anything about animal husbandry or cattle, it's clear that they're deranged and you know, their fur's falling off and they're drooling uncontrollably and they have all kinds of deformities. And Tennant, the farmer, was so concerned and didn't know what was going on, and nobody would come out to help him, that he started to do his own autopsies of the cows. And so that's a big part of the videos too, is he's taking out each organ one by one. So it's quite horrific. And when Bellott saw this, he realized that something seriously wrong was happening. And he started to do what he would do with any of his cases, which is essentially he got as much public information as he could about the company, about what they were dumping in this landfill that was next to the Tennant farm, and learned as much as he could But for a long time, he couldn't find any evidence of wrongdoing. He couldn't find any evidence of hazardous waste being dumped into this landfill. And it was only after he found one sort of stray document in a pile of thousands of documents that was sent to him mentioning a chemical called PFOA that he'd never heard of and none of his associates had ever heard of. But that started sort of a new stage of the investigation, and he started to figure out what this secret chemical was.
Mm. Sharon, did you want to jump in there?
Just that I think the cut of the video that Nathaniel is talking about is in our second piece, so people can go look for the case against DuPont on our website and look at it.
And I think it's also really telling that the farmer said in the video, every veterinarian that I've called will not return my call or they don't want to get involved. Can you explain that?
Yeah,
and just give us a sense of how ingrained DuPont is in this area or what?
Yeah, I mean, it's a familiar story. I mean, there's a huge factory, Washington Works, right at the edge of this town, which is Parkersburg. It's not that small. I mean, it's a city, and then there are all these suburbs around it. And but they're the big employer there, and they have an outsized presence in the community where a lot of the people who work there were, I should say, since there's been a lot of transition, as Sharon mentioned in the last couple of years, were deeply loyal. And there was a kind of omerta in this town that anybody who speaks poorly of their big employer was going to be ostracized and shut out. And so nobody wanted to get involved because they controlled the whole power structure of the town. And not only that, I think you could argue they controlled much of the power structure of West Virginia as well.
So as you said, the attorney Bellot was searching and searching. He stumbled upon a letter DuPont sent to the EPA that mentioned PFOA. And then what happened? I mean, he asked DuPont to share documentation related to this substance. DuPont refused. And then in the fall of 2000, he requested a court order to force them. And the order was granted. And that's when Bellot learned about so much information.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking, and that's the key moment in the story where DuPont essentially turned over everything, and by everything, I mean all of the information that we now have, essentially. 50 or so years of documentation showing that there was this that they'd been doing internal health studies, medical studies, environmental studies of PFOA, and its impact in the community and in human health and in the body. And they had found all these incredibly alarming things out about it. And there was also studies from 3M, who originally manufactured the substance. And it also showed that they had done nothing to tell, you know, the outside world about it. And why DuPont turned over all of this documentation, it's something about like 100,000 pages, is still something of a mystery. I mean, they were compelled legally to do so, but I think often when companies engaging in this level of malfeasance can find ways around doing so. But whatever the reason, whatever was going on within the corporate structure of DuPont, or within the legal team that was responsible for turning this stuff over, they just sent everything to Bellot. And Bellot, as meticulous, sort of fanatically meticulous as he is and careful, he put it all together. I mean, he arranged it chronologically, and he started to see this story. And at that point, he called the lawyer for DuPont, and he said, you know, I'm on to you. I know what you have. And DuPont settled pretty much right away. And but for Bellot, it was only the beginning, because he realized at this point it wasn't just these farmers in West Virginia who were losing their cows, but that this entire community of people, some 70,000, 80,000 people, were drinking water contaminated with PFOA and had been doing so for decades.
Mm. Sharon, it's really incredible. The attorney, Balot, said that DuPont had known for a long time that this stuff was bad. He said it was one of those things where you can't believe you're reading what you're reading, that it's actually been put in writing. It was the kind of stuff you always heard about happening, but you never thought you'd see it written down. So let's talk about what these documents revealed. He learned from these documents, 110,000 pages, that 3M and DuPont had been conducting secret medical studies on PFA for more than four decades. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that, Sharon?
That they've been doing it for more than four decades? Yeah, I mean, there was, you know, this is a company, they were the first company to have an in-house toxicology lab. So they were, and it's a company of scientists, so they're really carefully charting, you know, what they knew about the chemical. And you can see, you know, it's sort of honest scientific investigation for a good part of, you know, certainly the early stuff. You know, they tested on rats, they tested on dogs. You know, what does it do? They even had people smoke it at one point, or they put it into cigarettes. You know, they're trying to figure out what it does. And, you know, it gets interesting as time goes on and that information accumulates, you know, to see that there's a real diversity of opinion what to do with it. I mean, it's a giant company, and you can see that there are internal debates. And, you know, one of the things was they find abnormal liver function tests in workers who have this stuff in their blood. So, and then they end up, you know, debating what to do about it, and they end up not reporting it to the EPA because they decide that while they have these abnormal tests, it's not necessarily a health problem. You know, you have to report a health problem, but is that a health problem? They decide no. So it's very, when you read through this stuff, you realize, one, that it's a huge company, two, that they have, like, massive amounts of information, and then that they're really kind of, some of them, and, you know, there's conflict within about what to do about it. And eventually, you know, as we've said, eventually they decide, once they kind of, at a certain point, they go, wow, you know, this is kind of bad, to summarize, and we're going to go ahead anyway. You know, and that was in the 80s, and it was sort of this decision made at the top that, you know, one of the internal documents says, well, we're already liable for what's happened thus far, you know, and you can kind of see them make this calculation that's, you know, well, we're already in it, you know, let's keep going. And so, you know, that's a lot of what happens.
And so just to remind people, so PFOA is the chemical DuPont used to make Teflon. Products manufactured with PFOA were a very important part of the company's business, worth about $1 billion in profits. And just to give people some specifics, in 1961, DuPont researchers found that chemical could increase the size of the liver in rats and rabbits. In the 70s, it discovered there were high concentrations of PFOA in the blood of factory workers at Washington Works. They did not tell the EPA at that time. In 1983, they found that the ingestion of the substance caused birth defects in rats. And so that's the other thing, Nathaniel, is a lot of people are saying, all right, well, where's the government here? So throughout all of this, DuPont did not share any of this information with the EPA?
Yeah, and in fact, the EPA later fined them, essentially gave them a civil penalty. That's the largest civil penalty in the history of EPA, which is still something like $16.5 million, which is still quite a low number when you consider that they're making $1 billion of profit a year off of the substance. So, yeah, they you know, this idea that there are EPA regulators sort of lurking and trying to keeping a close watch on these companies to try to make sure that they're behaving well is a total fantasy. And that's something that, comes out quite clearly at you know, when you look at this story at any depth, and I think it's not just it's not just in the chemical industry, but I mean the EPA is largely toothless in a lot of these matters, and we kind of have a trust in them as a society that they're looking out for us, but it's they're they're sort of not empowered to do so.
Right. And then there's also a revolving door. One day you work for DuPont and the next day you work for the EPA. And we'll talk about that after the break. Nathaniel Rich wrote about the lawyer who exposed DuPont's decades-long history of chemical pollution for the New York Times Magazine. Sharon Lerner is a reporter for The Intercept. She's got a three-part series on DuPont and the chemistry of deception. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11... from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will have a conversation about coverage of the presidential primaries, which are in full swing. How are the media scrutinizing the candidates' records on actual issues? We'll also talk about the heated debate over freedom of expression in India following the arrest of several students. They were demonstrating at one of India's most prestigious universities. That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about DuPont's decades-long history of chemical pollution. We're joined by Nathaniel Rich. He wrote about the lawyer who exposed DuPont's history of chemical pollution. Sharon Lerner is a reporter with The Intercept. She's got a three-part series on DuPont and the chemistry of deception. And I hope you can take some time over the weekend. These are long pieces. They might take a couple hours to read, but really, really good reporting. And you can find their pieces at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about the DuPont Teflon scandal? Again, this chemical is in almost all of our bodies, 99.7% to be exact. So what questions do you have if you've worked in the chemical industry, if you've worked for DuPont, or you have friends or family who have? We'd love to hear from you. And if you've been part of a class action against a chemical company, what's your experience been like? And then the very important question, how should these companies be held accountable at a time when most chemicals have not been regulated? In fact, the EPA has restricted only 5 chemicals out of tens of thousands on the market over the last 40 years. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You've done extensive reporting about this, Sharon. I mean, we talked earlier about why these chemicals are not regulated in the first place, but what about the EPA's role in all of this?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. And let me just say about the sort of ongoing nature of this story. So since I did that three-part series in August of last year, we've done, 4 more stories about this chemical, and we have 2 big ones coming out next week. So it's sort of, you know, I feel like what we've been talking about is the beginning, and it's definitely a big unfurling matter. And as you say, a lot of it does have to do with the EPA. Unfortunately, there are limits in terms of what the EPA can do. But as I talk about in my third story, there was also a huge push on the part of DuPont to fight, to make sure that whatever happened, as it became clear that something was going to happen, right, because all this evidence is now out and there is this big lawsuit, you know, it becomes clear that something's going to have to happen. There's, you know, public outcry, a certain amount. They really wanted to control this process, and they did a fabulous job of doing that. They assembled this team of folks, many of whom used to work at the EPA. The guy in charge, this guy Mike McCabe, had been number two at the EPA. Another person on the team was also, I believe it was deputy administrator. They had someone on their board who was the former administrator at the EPA. So they had people who were very familiar with the agency and, importantly, were able to have really open channels of communication between the company and the agency. And so they, you know, they very much controlled how this went down. And what happened was, you know, there was responses, Nathaniel mentioned, they were fined, and it was a small fine. A couple other things happened, but before we get to those, it's important to note that what didn't happen was any sort of binding regulation. The chemical wasn't banned. It was the subject of a voluntary phasing out, right? Which, again, DuPont was very involved in how that played out. And there were big negotiations between this team that was defending C8 and the EPA. And what ended up happening was there was a fine. They also withdrew the chemical along with anyone else who, there are seven, I believe, other companies that either use or make PFOA. And then also they kind of agreed to do this research. And it was research that would have helped, theoretically, the EPA to regulate it. It was on how much chemical is in the environment around the Parkersburg plant. How much is in the water? How much is in the air? There's a lot of stuff that the EPA, as a federal agency, doesn't have the resources to figure out on its own. And so EPA agreed. I'm sorry, DuPont agreed to do this for them and submit the information to the agency. But it was very clear that the terms on which it wanted to do this were not binding. It wasn't going to be, it was a voluntary agreement they were entering into. You know, and there was some outcry at the time, well, wait a minute, you know, should this be voluntary? You know, and they said, the company said, well, you know what, it's public. If we don't do what we say, you know, people can call us to task for it. Well, years and years went by. And they did continue to submit information to the agency, but they didn't fully do what the agency asked. And, you know, there are all these letters back and forth, wait, but you didn't do this, you didn't test cows, you didn't test blood, you didn't test vegetables, you know, all this communication back and forth. And in the end, DuPont did not fulfill its end of that promise. To submit all this information that would be helpful in regulating the chemical. Mm-hmm. And in the end, there was nothing that the EPA could do about it.
Wow.
And so it was very dispiriting to read through all this and to see that, you know, partly this is about the limits of a somewhat cash-strapped government agency. But the other side of that is that, you know, they were facing an opponent that was incredibly, like, sort of infinitely resourced and very well connected to the agency itself, and they were, as I see it, essentially outfoxed in the end. You know, the agency was left with a promise that wasn't fulfilled. They did succeed in getting this voluntary agreement, which they make a lot about, that, you know, now C8 and longer-chain perfluorinated chemicals, you know, more than 8 carbons, are not produced in the U.S. anymore, and that is a big deal. But in terms of getting regulation that would allow, like under the Clean Water Act, for instance, that would allow people to get the companies that put require the companies that put this stuff into the water to clean it up and pay for all that, that hasn't happened. And the other thing that has been very frustrating is that in 2009, the EPA did say, you know what, we're going to set this provisional level for what's safe in water. And they set it at, you know, 0.4 parts per billion in drinking water. But that has been remained provisional, so it's not really enforced. It's not, you know, a binding regulation. And it's also, it turns out, quite high. And it's also, it's based on, like, short-term exposure, so it's much higher than it would be if it were based on a lifetime. And still, that is what's in use to this day. So now as we see the chemical popping up around the country, and there is a piece on our website called It's called a special report on firefighting foam, but it has a great map of where PFOA is around the country. And it's now not just in the water of the folks in West Virginia and Ohio around that plant, but it's in the drinking water of millions of people around the country.
So right, and I'm glad you brought that up, because Nathaniel, in the piece that you wrote about safety limits, the lawyer Balot said that the same DuPont lawyers tasked with writing the safety limit had become the government regulators responsible for enforcing that limit. And you report that the Environmental Working Group has found these fluorochemicals present in 94 water districts across 27 states. The drinking water in Parkersburg itself, whose water district was not included in the original class action and has failed to compel DuPont to pay for a filtration system, is currently tainted with high levels of PFOA, and most residents appear not to know about this? Is that still the case?
I spent a couple of days in Parkersburg, and I stayed at a very nice hotel there, the Blennerhassett, and it's a cute little town, and it's a beautiful hotel, and I didn't take a shower while I was there or drink any of the water. I mean, I was having, you know, at the time I was immersed in all the stuff, in the research, and yeah, nobody there seems to really be aware of this. I mean, people are aware of the ongoing sort of legal issues, but they're not that tuned into it. And if you ask, you know, someone on the street or someone at the hotel about it, they don't really know what you're talking about. And but it's true also in, you know, all these other cities and water districts where the water has been tainted with this stuff. I mean, nobody really knows. I mean, the Environmental Working Group has done an analysis where they've taken a lot of, I think, a lot of figures from EPA that haven't really been made public in an easily accessible way, and they've gone through it, and they have a good chart and a map of where it's showed up. But it hasn't, you know, it's not like they've tested the water everywhere. Mm. This is just in a select number of communities where the water has been tested. But yeah, the revolving door between DuPont and West Virginia EPA is pretty shocking, and it's something I wrote about a little bit in the piece, as you mentioned. But that's the sort of the brazenness with which DuPont would just insert its own lawyers into the hierarchy of the West Virginia EPA, including at one point the director of the entire West Virginia EPA, was shocking. I think it was shocking to Balot. Wasn't shocking to his legal colleagues who worked in West Virginia, however.
Sharon?
Yeah, I was just going to say, for the screening, it is actually, it has been added, PFOA, to this list of chemicals that they do now routinely screen for. And so the EPA screens water districts that serve more than 10,000 people for a list of chemicals. So it's on that list. And so we actually did take the data from the EPA, and we have folks who made a map somewhat like the EWG one that you're mentioning, Nathaniel, but ours is a little bit more recent. But you can see that from visually, it's pretty amazing. It is spread throughout the country, and this is, again, from the EPA monitoring. And it's ongoing, so they keep this. You know, they're updating it every few months.
And again, PFOA is the chemical DuPont used to make Teflon. Evidence suggests that DuPont knew as early as 1954 that C8 was toxic. By 1961, its studies found that, I'm sorry, PFOA and C8 are the same thing. So we'll just use PFOA. It can get confusing. It was caused enlarged livers in rats and rabbits, and then independent studies have shown that PFOA is connected to high cholesterol, thyroid disease, testicular cancer, ovarian cancer, reduced fertility, altered immune responses in children, lymphoma. The list just goes on and on. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback feedback@yourcallradio.org. Nathaniel Rich wrote about the lawyer who exposed DuPont's decades-long history of chemical pollution for the New York Times Magazine. Sharon Lerner is a reporter with The Intercept, and she has been writing an ongoing series about DuPont and the chemistry of deception. Let's go to Pat in San Francisco. Hi, Pat. Welcome to the show.
Yes. I had two things. One, in regards to the Teflon, what risks are there using cooking utensils that have it? And then the second thing, as a Vietnam-era veteran, my concern is these chemical companies that were involved in the making of Agent Orange.
Yes. Well, thank you for calling. Sharon, do you want to take the first one? Cooking utensils with Teflon?
Sure. Yeah, this question comes up a lot. And so it's my understanding that really Teflon itself isn't, number one, it's not our main source of exposure. Because, and that, by the way, is actually from coatings, stain and water-resistant coatings on carpets. But the other thing is that the way it comes out in from pans is if they're heated very high. Apparently there is a danger if a Teflon-coated pan gets heated above 400 degrees. But besides that, you know, it's there are perhaps little tiny bits of it, but again, it's not our major source of exposure.
Did we lose Sharon? Okay. Nathaniel, do you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I'd throw out your Teflon pans. I mean, the idea of having cookware that is safe as long as you don't heat it up is somewhat Orwellian, maybe, to me. But there was a big scare about the Teflon pans about, I want to say, like 2003. There were, as this story was developing in West Virginia, this sort of came to the attention of the national media. And I think, you know, 60 Minutes did a big special about it and about Parkersburg. And I remember at the time being throwing out my Teflon pan, which was heavily scarred and abused at that point. And so and then people kind of forgot about it, I think. And as what often happens in our culture, it's sort of it stopped being getting as much attention and then people went back to using them. And I don't, you know, now Teflon is made with a slightly different chemical or in the manufacturing process. They've substituted this other chemical that's known as C6. So it's slightly more biodegradable, but no testing really has been done by independent sources, and there's a lot of question about whether it's much safer than C8.
Hmm. And Nathaniel, did you do much research or reading about Agent Orange during your research process? I just found a piece at Truthout about investigations and archives uncovered that the Agent Orange manufacturer Dow knew as early as 1965 that the contaminant was one of the most toxic materials known.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, not really relevant for my piece. But, yeah, there's a lot. And that was Dow and Monsanto. And Dow is, you know, as we've discussed, is merging with DuPont. And that's one of the other more famous examples of this kind of thing going on. But it's not, you know, they're not alone. I mean, there's countless examples of situations where companies have gotten away with using toxic chemicals and knowing that they were toxic and not being held to account until, you know, a book like Civil Action comes out or the Aaron Brockovich movie or things like that, or enters the public consciousness. But you know, there's something like 60 or 80,000 industrial chemicals in use right now, and we don't scrutinize the high majority of them. And now, you know, the high majority of them are probably safe, but we don't really have any apparatus for determining that independently.
Right. Well, and also, just for your information, Pat, you probably already know this, but the VA has a page for veterans exposed to Agent Orange who deserve compensation and can get compensation. I'm sure you have to fill out a lot of information, but this information is online. Thank you for calling in. Let's go next to Dick in San Francisco. Hi, Dick. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. In the 60s, the early 60s, I was in the service, and I worked on a lot of electronic equipment. And at the time, in the Air Force, they started using Teflon as an insulator on the wires. That was okay because you got a thinner wire. But if you went to repair it, then you had to solder it, and you melted the Teflon, you got this very dense smoke coming off. And you had to be careful about insulating it, about inhaling it. Otherwise, you could get the shakes. There were warnings about staying away from heated Teflon.
Wow.
Now we move forward to when I was out of the service and they came out with the Teflon pans. I wouldn't let my wife buy a Teflon pan because I knew what transpired once the stuff got heated. If you got a flame on the Teflon, who's to say that it wasn't exposing you to something toxic? And I think at the time it was called TFE Teflon.
Hmm.
And it took a long time before that stuff became, quote, safe. I don't know if it's safe now, but I think it does, it the way it's used, it doesn't emit smoke so easily, and it doesn't infect you. But I was exposed to it very frequently in the 60s, the early 60s.
And how are you doing today?
I wish I could blame everything on the Teflon. I don't think it hurt me, but I don't know for sure.
Well, see, that's the thing. Can you talk about this, Nathaniel? How do people make a direct connection? I mean, can you talk about the 70,000 people who were drinking PFOA-laced drinking water and just how so many West Virginians were tested and what that study found?
Yeah, and hearing those stories, I'm reminded also of Darlene Kiger and her first husband, who worked at the plant, Washington Works, in West Virginia, and they would get sick after inhaling all this smoke in the making Teflon, and the workers would call it Teflon flu. They would kind of joke about it. He would come home with Teflon flu, and then they wouldn't let him come back for a couple of days. So they knew that something bad was going on. And that was in the 70s. But, yeah, as for the 70,000 people, how do you prove causality? That's the question that your caller raised.
Right.
And it's very difficult. And essentially what happened in this large class action suit is that they did a kind of medical study as a part of at the end of the first phase of the class action suit. And they basically said, we're going to take this incredible amount of data from testing everybody in this community, 70,000 people, who were all given a check in order to have their blood drawn and tested. So they got this enormous amount of population data, and they also had enormous amount of environmental data about the concentration of PFOA in drinking water and in the air and so on. And basically, they agreed that if they were to find, if the independent scientists that both sides nominated were able to find correlation between PFOA ingestion and any diseases, that anybody who had those diseases would be able to sue them for personal injury lawsuits. And so that took 7 years of waiting to find out whether these independent epidemiologists could figure out whether there was any causal link. And they did an enormous amount of science. And they, at the end, they announced there were six conditions that they said there was a causal link. And so anybody with those six conditions, which are many of the ones you've mentioned, but not all of them. I don't think ovarian cancer, for instance, was one of them. Anybody who have those six conditions as a term of the lawsuit is now able to file a personal injury suit. And so something like 3,600 people so far have come forward with one of these six conditions. It's everything from high cholesterol to a couple kinds of cancer. And that's ongoing. And that's just the first of those 3,600 suits was won by the plaintiff against DuPont. The second was just settled, I think, in the last week, and there's about 3,600 more to go. And at any time, DuPont can decide to essentially settle with everybody and figure out a formula based on how sick they are and what kind of illness they have But it's they're not allowed to challenge the fact of causation. That was sort of what was determined in the original agreement.
And so
causation
just,
is assumed, but that only holds for that population.
And so just to be clear, in December 2011, as you mentioned, after 7 years of studying the blood of 70,000 West Virginians, the scientists began to release their findings. There was a, quote, probable link between PFOA and kidney cancer, testicular cancer, thyroid disease, high cholesterol, is this eclampsia?
Yeah.
And can you help me with this one? Ulcerative colitis?
It's an ulceritis.
Thank
yeah, it's,
you.
It's a basically extreme it's stomach problems, frankly.
Okay.
I mean, it's incontinence and pain.
And then the other ones that I mentioned, including thyroid disease, ovarian cancer, those came up in later studies. Is that right, Sharon? Because you've got
thyroid disease is one of the six. So it's preeclampsia, ulcerative colitis, the two types of cancer. There are six in all that are probable links. But the other ones, ovarian cancer, there's a lot of data pointing to, for instance, connections with prostate cancer, with many other diseases. But in terms of the lawsuit, it's those six.
And we're getting a few emails just from concerned individuals saying, how do we get our blood tested and how concerned should we be?
I can take that. But I feel like if they're not in a highly exposed area, which is to say, you know, their water should be tested and they could actually go on the EPA website, the public information, and look at the UCMR3 data for PFOA, which is complicated, but you can do it. But you should be alerted by your water provider if there is an elevated level. But I think, unless you know that you're in a highly exposed area, I wouldn't elevate it over other concerns right now, as we've been talking about. There are many, many chemicals, and one of the most upsetting things about this story to me is that we kind of are focused in on this chemical because of the faucet and because of these crazy circumstances, all this information came out about it.
Right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we're talking about doing a week-long series on chemicals. We're also going to do another show about water, and we would love to have both of you back for that. Nathaniel Rich wrote about the lawyer who exposed DuPont's decades-long history of chemical pollution for the New York Times Magazine. Sharon Lerner has been investigating DuPont and the chemistry of deception for The Intercept. Find their stories, yourcallradio.org. Thank you both for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll have a conversation about media coverage of the presidential primaries. With the elections in full swing, how are the media scrutinizing the candidates' records on actual issues? We'll also discuss the heated debate about freedom of expression in India following the arrest of several students over demonstrations at one of India's most prestigious universities. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.